Hearing will come to order. Good morning. Today's hearing will provide the subcommittee an opportunity to learn more about the Department of Veterans Affairs influenza vaccination program. Since the National Response Plan is a blueprint, published by the Department of Homeland Security is a blueprint for the coordinated efforts of federal agencies during disasters, the subcommittee had also intended to hear testimony regarding interagency collaboration, and I underline that for emphasis, interagency collaboration, or lack thereof, if you will, and coordination, or lack thereof, between VA, the Department of Defense, the Department of Health and Human Services, and the Department of Homeland Security with regards to a potential outbreak of a pandemic flu. Unfortunately, it is a busy time of the year, and the Department of Homeland Security's key witness in a potential flu pandemic is on travel. I learned yesterday morning that the Department of Defense was also unable to send a witness to discuss their role in a possible flu pandemic. The subcommittee had also requested testimony from the Surgeon General. However, according to HHS, the Surgeon General was not involved in the planning and preparation for a flu pandemic, which I find puzzling, since the Surgeon General's duties, I believe, would require him to mobilize, deploy, and exert leadership and oversight of the Commissioned Corps in the event of a pandemic. I would also expect that the Surgeon General's office would be the lead in any national public health education campaign. The subcommittee will continue to explore this issue. I do have, as you might imagine, serious concerns regarding the level of interagency collaboration and coordination between federal departments in their ability to adequately respond to a flu pandemic. The need for interagency collaboration and coordination on this issue is a matter that I will be recommending the committee pursue in the second session of this Congress. Full Committee Chairman Booyer and I serve on the Energy and Commerce Committee, which has jurisdiction over public health issues. Given the cross-jurisdictional issues, I'm sure that we will be working with our colleagues in the Energy and Commerce Committee on this important issue. As we're all aware, influenza is highly contagious, spreading through direct contact and aerosol exposure. The virus can also persist for several hours on inanimate objects such as toys or doorknobs. In addition, influenza is infectious before symptoms appear in its victims, which enhances the virus's ability to spread. While the virus is usually non-lethal in healthy individuals, it can cause severe medical complications in a hospital environment, especially in an inpatient setting. These complications can severely degrade a sick individual's medical condition and in some cases cause death. Since VA provides care to millions of older veterans who are considered high risk, this certainly is a serious concern. Over the past several years, there has been widespread discussion and preparation for a potential flu pandemic. As numerous health officials have previously stated, an influenza pandemic is likely at some point in time. My Energy and Commerce Health Committee devoted an entire hearing to this subject some time ago. Historical records suggest that influenza pandemics have occurred periodically for at least four centuries. In the 20th century alone, there were three influenza pandemics. The 1918 Spanish flu pandemic killed between 20 and 100 million people worldwide and at least 500,000 in the United States. The 1957 Asian flu pandemic killed about 69,800 people in the United States. The 1968 Hong Kong flu killed about 33,800 people in the United States. In 1997, the H5N1 avian flu emerged in Hong Kong and reemerged in 2003, and it is this virus that has caused the greatest concern for the potential of a flu pandemic. According to the VA, which, as I understand it, has a very good story to tell, we're very proud to say, according to the VA, influenza and prevention is a public health priority for the department. On an annual basis, the VA, under Secretary for Health, issues a Veterans Health Administration directive that provides policy and implementation guidance on the use of influenza vaccine. The VHA flu directive and VA's flu vaccination program does coincide with the national vaccination campaign. We're anxious to learn more about VA's annual flu immunization program. As I've said earlier, it's my understanding that the department has been extremely proactive in its efforts to educate and administer a highly successful preventive health campaign. And again, I commend them for that. I would now like to recognize Ranking Member Mr. Strickland from Ohio. Mr. Strickland.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, for holding this hearing. We are all interested in knowing how the Department of Veterans Affairs handles what some may think of as a routine and reoccurring function by hearing testimony on VA's annual flu vaccination program. We're also interested in testimony regarding the threat of emerging or reoccurring infectious diseases and the VA's preparedness to meet such threats, especially the avian flu threat. To call VA's annual flu program routine really does not alert one to the seriousness of the potential threat, and I think we all realize that. For example, as has been mentioned, the 1918 influenza pandemic, also called the Spanish flu, killed between 20 and 40 million people worldwide in a one-year period of time. This flu was easily transmitted from person to person and had a mortality rate of 2.5%, much higher than other influenzas of the day, and was particularly deadly for the age group, those between 20 and 40 years of age. This age group is a different group from those usually impacted severely by other strains of influenza. In fact, this particular strain of the flu is considered so virulent that the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services has published an interim final rule to add some reconstructed replication competent forms of the 1918 pandemic influenza virus to the list of HHS select agents and toxins. The HHS select list contains biological agents or toxins that could pose a severe threat to public health and safety, to animal and plant health, or animal or plant products. It affects their possession, use, and transportation. A review of the HHS list finds other select agents, mostly viruses, which will kill humans quickly in horrible and effective waves. Variants of the 1918 Spanish influenza have now joined the ranks of Ebola, Lassa fever, Marlborough, Crimean, Congo, and South American hemorrhagic fever, and the Rift Valley fever virus. Considering the company that at least one strain of the flu now keeps, we certainly can't think of influenza and our efforts to combat it as routine. Now, today we will hear how the VA administers its annual influenza vaccination program. We will hear about the program's problems and successes. We will also hear about resources and methodologies for assuring that the flu vaccine need is met. We remember the vaccine shortages of last year, something we do not want to repeat nationally or VA-wide for the upcoming flu season. We hope to also hear about the surveillance and control problems for infectious diseases that are used by VA. Finally, I anticipate we may hear testimony regarding the possible avian flu pandemic. The threat is a real threat that we hope we do not have to face unprepared. I'm interested in how the experts today rank the threat of H5N1 strain of the avian flu. Some experts see similarities between this strain of the avian flu and the Spanish flu of 1918. We know that viruses do mutate, so the question becomes, is the H5N1 strain of avian influenza a significant threat today as compared with other infectious diseases, and will future mutations likely make it more or less of a threat to humans? Our panel of witnesses today contains several distinguished VA experts on infectious diseases, and we thank you for being here. Unfortunately, other invited guests were unable to be with us from HHS and DOD. I am sure that they would have provided the perspective of their respective agencies on this general problem had they been here. Perhaps there will be a hearing in the future, Mr. Chairman, when we can invite them to testify before us. To reduce the threat of dangerous viruses, we may isolate, we may vaccinate, or treat the problem. We have sometimes, as a nation and as a healthcare community, taken special steps to vaccinate against emerging strains of what was considered a viral agent. For example, in 1976, the U.S. implemented a massive program to vaccinate the nation against the swine flu. The decision to begin the swine flu vaccination program is still questioned from many viewpoints, but the target strain of the swine flu never reappeared after the first case that was found at Fort Dix, New Jersey. But this fact alone does not invalidate the 1976 decision to implement that national vaccination program for swine flu. So I anticipate the VA and this nation's healthcare community will keep one eye firmly fixed on the avian flu and the other eye scanning the horizon for newly emerging strains or other communicable and deadly agents. We must strike a balance of anticipation for what is the known threat and the anticipation of threats that are not known or anticipated. Where national security and the welfare of this nation's citizens are at stake, we must not let our general and broad-based preparedness lapse because we anticipate a single vector. Mr. Chairman, I thank you once again for this hearing, and I thank the witnesses for being here, and I look forward to hearing what they have to share with us.
And I thank the gentleman. Would the gentleman from Arkansas have an opening statement?
No, I don't. I just appreciate you and the ranking member having this hearing at this time. It certainly is, you know, is a topic that's so important, and really look forward to the testimony.
Well, thank you, sir, and I thank you for making the hearing this morning. So at this time, I would like to recognize our first and only panel. Dr. Lawrence Deaton is Chief Consultant, Public Health, Strategic Healthcare Group of the U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs. Dr. Lawrence will be accompanied by Victoria Davey, Deputy Chief Consultant, Public Strategic Healthcare Group, the U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs. Dr. Robert Muter is the Staff Physician Hospital Epidemiologist with the Veterans Affairs Pittsburgh Healthcare System. And Dr. Denise Cardo is Director of the Division of Healthcare Quality Promotion with the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, Department of Health and Human Services. Thank you so very much for taking time to come here and extending us the courtesy of meeting our invitation. And I say invitation, we use that term a little loosely, and it's a very soft term. But I'm always concerned that we maybe, you're all busy people, as are those who could not be here with us today. And I'm always concerned that we've given them adequate notice. Because plans are made well in advance sometimes. But once we're satisfied that we have given adequate notice, then it's more than just an invitation, and it should be that way. Well, I would ask you to, your written testimony is a part of the record. I'd ask you to limit your oral testimony to 5 minutes if you could, or as close to it as you can. I would now recognize Dr. Deaton, I suppose, would be first. Yes. Dr. Deaton, please proceed. Is that mic on? It doesn't look like it's...
Now it is.
Okay, now it is.
Thank you very much, sir. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, we do sincerely appreciate the opportunity to be here today to discuss VA activities related to both the seasonal influenza as well as the pandemic influenza, other infectious disease issues confronting the VA, and particularly glad that Dr. Cardo is with us. We work very closely with the CDC and other agencies and look forward to discussing that with you. Mr. Chairman, influenza vaccination is one of the VA's highest priorities in public health. We've established an annual program to promote influenza vaccination that, frankly, Mr. Chairman, is unequaled in effectiveness by any other integrated healthcare system. The annual VA seasonal influenza vaccination campaign is composed of 5 interrelated system-wide activities that I'll very briefly review. First, as you already said, the Undersecretary for Health issues an influenza vaccination directive to the entire VA healthcare system that requires our healthcare facility directors to implement an annual active influenza vaccination program for both patients and staff. Second, each year the VA launches a system-wide influenza vaccine campaign and distributes an influenza vaccine toolkit to each VA facility with resources to help those facilities organize, promote, and carry out their local vaccination programs. Third is VA's timely purchase and distribution of influenza vaccine itself. VA solicits bids for our vaccine supply every January and distributes that supply each fall and winter. Over the past 8 years, VA has steadily increased the amount of influenza vaccine purchased, buying slightly less than 1 million doses back in 1998 and an estimated 2.4 million doses for this influenza season at a cost of approximately $18.5 million. Fourth, VA provides ongoing guidance to frontline healthcare staff during each influenza season. Last year, the Undersecretary for Health issued 7 separate advisories to our frontline staff between October and February, mostly to deal with the issues related with the shortage that you've already referred to, Mr. Chairman. Already this year, we've issued 3 advisories to the field. VA's fifth activity, which is key to the success of our influenza vaccination program, is that we hold our health care managers accountable through a VA-wide performance measure on influenza vaccination. The results of our approach to influenza vaccination are better than any other health care organization for which there are data. By our chart review program, VA-wide influenza vaccination rate for veterans age 50 or older was 75% in 2003 season and 75% again last year, despite the shortages last year. By a phone survey that we perform, 88% of veterans report that they have been vaccinated for influenza. In contrast, the CDC phone survey report of adults over the age of 65, and that's a high-risk group, much more likely to be vaccinated than those over the age of 50. The CDC survey showed only 68% of average citizens were vaccinated in 2003 and 63% in 2004.
Is that 88% or 85%, whatever the figure is that of all veterans or just those that qualify for treatment at the VA centers? In other words, are on the list.
The 88% is of veterans who are eligible for VA care who are over the age of 65.
Okay.
So the highest risk group that we know that we want to make sure and get vaccinated because they're at higher risk of complications. A survey of the Medicare population, sir, again over the age of 65, but Medicare population has the advantage of having influenza vaccine covered under Medicare. That survey showed a rate that was nearly identical to the VA rate for those over the age of 50. CDC has also shown that commercial insurance plan influenza vaccination rates for ages 50 to 64 were also only 52% in 2003, and it dropped to 28% in 2004. Again, that's the year last year when we had the shortage. So we're proud of the success that VA has had in the seasonal influenza vaccination program, but we constantly are seeking ways to improve it, such as putting emphasis this year on vaccinating healthcare facility staff to make sure they stay healthy and that they don't transmit influenza to their patients. VA also strongly supports the President's proposal currently being considered to create capacity for annual influenza vaccination for every man, woman, and child in this country. Mr. Chairman, let me now turn to pandemic influenza. We don't know when or where pandemic influenza will strike, but based on its history that you reviewed for us, we believe that it will. And because the VA healthcare facilities are located in all states and nearly every community in the nation, we liken VA to a fine meshed sieve when it comes to infectious disease and public health threats to our nation. If it happens anywhere in the nation, veterans will be affected and VA facilities will need to be ready to respond. VA's pandemic influenza preparedness program is comprised of 8 interrelated activities. First, VA's pandemic influenza preparedness is being built on the foundation of our successful seasonal influenza vaccination program, which I just described. Second, VA has established a stockpile of the antiviral drug oseltamivir, or Tamiflu, which may be the only effective human drug against the current strain of influenza that's causing disease in birds and sporadically in humans in Asia. Last fall, the VA stockpiled 5.5 million capsules of this drug, oseltamivir, for pandemic emergencies, which will be distributed only if and when a pandemic might occur. Third, Mr. Chairman, there is a worldwide shortage of this drug, oseltamivir, and VA researchers have initiated a study that may help us extend the effective supply of that drug by co-administration with a drug called probenecid. That's a drug that can slow the elimination of other drugs from the body. Positive study results could have a significant impact on the VA supply as well as the nation's supply of the drug oseltamivir. Fourth, we developed and distributed a respiratory infectious disease emergency plan for VA facilities. Based on our experiences with preparation for other recent infectious disease challenges, including anthrax in 2001, the smallpox vaccination program several years ago, SARS, the influenza vaccine shortages from last year, and now the specter of pandemic influenza. This plan is a resource for VA frontline providers and administrators for preparations, planning, and responses needed to assure continued patient care, communication, staffing, and facility operations. Fifth, VA has been a full participant, Mr. Chairman, in U.S. government-wide pandemic influenza planning efforts led by the White House and led by the Department of Health and Human Services. VA also is helping to develop the national pandemic influenza plan being coordinated by the White House, from which federal agency-specific plans will flow. The national plan is due January 1st of 2006, and the VA plan, which is well along in development, is due February 1st. Sixth, because even the best plans need to be tested, we will conduct an operational tabletop exercise on pandemic influenza to test the VA plan and, as we would in a pandemic, also test coordination and communication among VA, state and local health officials, and our other federal agency partners that will need to respond. Seventh, by smart use of the VA's National Electronic Medical Record System, we hope to provide real-time surveillance and reporting of illness suggestive of influenza if a pandemic looms. The President's budget request on pandemic influenza preparedness, now pending before Congress, includes resources to allow the VA to do real-time reporting of influenza syndromic activity directly to the Centers for Disease Control as part of a system already being built to improve VA surveillance of healthcare-associated infections. Finally, Mr. Chairman, we've developed and we actively promote a national education campaign called Infection, Don't Pass It On, to engage VA staff, VA patients, and visitors to any of our medical centers around the country in preventing transmission of infection. Because even in the absence of an effective vaccine or supplies of antiviral medicines, there is something each of us can do to limit the impact of a pandemic influenza. Common sense approaches that our mothers and grandmothers all taught us really do work. Wash your hands frequently. Cover your coughs and sneezes. If you're sick, stay at home so you don't infect other people. This campaign, Infection Don't Pass It On, uses over 100 educational posters and other materials and is actively promoted across the VA healthcare system and is used in some local, state, and private healthcare organizations. DOD healthcare providers use this, and other countries have adopted the VA plan, including Wales and Australia. Mr. Chairman, around us are some posters from that campaign as an example of the kinds of materials that we have available. In summary, VA has a successful program for seasonal influenza vaccination and has begun to apply that approach to prepare for a possible pandemic influenza. I assure you, Mr. Chairman, VA will continue to protect our veterans, our employees, and the VA healthcare system against seasonal influenza and to build strong defense against pandemic influenza as we fully implement the national strategy outlined by the President. VA will be there for veterans who rely on us for their health care. This concludes my statement. We're happy to answer any questions you have, sir. And again, thank you very much for this opportunity.
Thank you, Doctor. Ms. Davey, is there any brief comments you'd like to make at this point? Brief, of course, but at the same time, you've taken time to be here. No? All right. Dr. Muter, your on, sir.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, thank you for inviting me here. My invitation came somewhat late, so as your staff knows, I did not submit written testimony. At the VA Pittsburgh Healthcare Center, I'm the hospital epidemiologist, which means I'm in charge of preventing infection transmission in our hospital. Under the direction and encouragement of VA Central Office, we have a multifaceted approach toward combating influenza in our healthcare system, which consists of three separate campuses. We have a very aggressive immunization program directed at getting the vaccine to our veterans. It consists of reminders, both by mail and by telephone. Through the months of October through December, we run a walk-in influenza clinic for our patients. We actively promote receipt of influenza in our during regular clinic visits, and we have a program to immunize essentially all of our long-term care residents. In addition, we have a very good success in getting our employees immunized. 75% of our employees have received the flu vaccine so far this year, including 95% of our direct caregivers in our long-term care facility. We also have a program to identify cases of influenza rapidly, both presenting from the community and occurring in an epidemic fashion in our long-term care facility. This involves regular communication with our local health department for activity of documentation of influenza activity in our community, rapid influenza antigen testing, and this year we have going to be able to back that up through a collaboration with the University of Pittsburgh to get rapid molecular confirmation through PCR testing at the University of Pittsburgh Virology Lab. We have a plan which we actually have used several times in past years to combat influenza outbreaks in our long-term care facility, which may occur despite near universal immunization. And this involves isolation, exclusion of sick employees, and providing influenza prophylactic drugs to our patients at risk. And we have actually done this five times in the 20 years since I've been working at the VA. In addition to our influenza activities, we have a number of innovative approaches to infection control and the spread of other infectious diseases within the hospital, which are really one of the most significant risks that a hospital patient undergoes. 4 years ago, we entered into a collaborative agreement with the Centers for Disease Control and the Pittsburgh Regional Healthcare Initiative, which is a group of hospitals, employers, and insurers in western Pennsylvania to pilot a control program for methicillin-resistant staph, or MRSA, which has historically been the number one hospital-acquired pathogen in our facility. This involved bringing industrial engineering processes to bear on solving the problem. It included increasing staph education and awareness of the consequences of MRSA infection, the means of transmission, and the approaches necessary to prevent transmission, and also included removing those barriers to hand hygiene and isolation. This included identifying patients with surveillance cultures for MRSA on admission, immediately isolating patients, developing a computerized system to notify the wards each day of patients who were needed to be in isolation, providing appropriate hand sanitizer, isolation equipment for staff, and monitoring their usage. We initially started this in fiscal year 2001 on a general surgical unit. Within 2 years, we had experienced a 75% decrease in MRSA infection on that unit. We then applied this to our surgical intensive care unit, and within 1 year had a similar reduction in the rate of MRSA infection. Starting this past fall, we initiated a comprehensive MRSA control program throughout our facility, which included all units in both the acute and long-term care facility. We are doing surveillance cultures on all patients. We are putting those patients in isolation, providing staff with the training and equipment that they need in order to isolate these patients effectively. Our administration, we continue to have the collaboration and support of the CDC and the Pittsburgh Regional Healthcare Initiative. In addition, our hospital administration has been very, very supportive. In addition to actively promoting this, they have actually enlisted our hospital in a community-wide effort under the auspices of the CDC and the Allegheny County Health Department to make this a regional initiative. They've also invited the directors of our VISN to Pittsburgh for a meeting in which we presented this program to the directors of our VISN, and are continuing to promote this as a potential VISN-wide initiative. And we've had a great increase and a great deal of interest from a number of the hospitals within our VISN who've contacted us to get additional information in terms of the particulars of the program, the results, and the resources necessary to recreate our experience in their hospitals.
Thank you very much, Doctor. Dr. Cardo? Is that correct? Did I pronounce that correctly?
Yes, you did.
Okay.
Good morning, and thank you for the invitation to testify on influenza pandemic planning. CDC and other agencies are working together to prepare the United States for this potential threat to our union, to our nation. In order for an influenza virus to cause a pandemic, it must first to be a virus to which there is little or no pre-existing immunity in the human population. Second, be able to cause illness in humans. And third, have the ability for sustained person-to-person transmission. So far, the H5N1 virus circulating in Asia meets the first and two criteria, but not yet the third. In the current H5N1 outbreaks in Asia, since January 2004, 138 human cases have been confirmed by the WHO. These cases have resulted in 71 deaths, a fatality rate of around 50%. We cannot predict the severity and impact of an influenza pandemic, whether from H5N1, virus currently circulating in Asia and Europe, or the emergence of another influenza virus of pandemic potential. However, modeling studies suggest that a median level pandemic could result in 89 to 207,000 deaths. A more severe pandemic, as happened in 1918, could have a much greater impact. There are several important points to note about pandemic, about influenza. First, pandemics happen. There were three during the past century. Second, the capacity to intervene and control the spread of the virus once it gains the ability for sustained person-to-person transmission will be extremely limited. An outbreak anywhere in the world increases the risk everywhere. Third, H5N1 avian influenza strain that is circulating in Asia among birds is currently considered the leading candidate to cause the next pandemic. However, it is possible that another influenza virus, which could originate anywhere in the world, could cause the next pandemic. This uncertainty is one reason we need ongoing laboratory surveillance on influenza viruses that affect humans. And fourth, because early detection means having more time to respond, it is critical for the United States to collaborate with domestic and global partners to expand and strengthen the scope of early warning surveillance activities. In the United States, the HHS Pandemic Influenza Plan is a blueprint for pandemic influenza preparedness and response, and provides guidance to state, to national, state, and local policymakers and health departments with the goal of achieving a national state of readiness and quick response. Among CDC's roles in preparation for a pandemic, we are working to ensure that states have sufficient epidemiologic and laboratory capacity, both to identify novel viruses throughout the year and to sustain surveillance during a pandemic. We are improving reporting systems so that influenza information needed to make public health decisions is available quickly. And we are enhancing monitoring of resistance to current antiviral drugs to guide policy to their use. Another aspect of preparedness, and one with which I work directly, involves the healthcare system. Healthcare facilities, including those in the VA, need to be prepared for the potential rapid pace and changing characteristics of a pandemic. With input from our partners, CDC has developed guidance that provides healthcare facilities with recommendations for developing plans to respond to an influenza pandemic, and guidance on the use of appropriate infection control measures to prevent transmission during patient care. Tabletop exercises have identified gaps and provided recommendations for healthcare facilities to improve their readiness to respond. In conclusion, although much has been accomplished, more preparation is needed for a possible human influenza pandemic. As the President mentioned during the announcement of his national strategy for pandemic influenza, our first line of defense is early detection. CDC is closely monitoring the international situation in collaboration with WHO, current affected countries, and other partners. We're using our extensive networks of partners to enhance pandemic influenza planning. And lastly, the national response to the annual domestic influenza seasons provides a core foundation for how the nation will face and address pandemic influenza. Thank you for the opportunity to share this information with you, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Doctor. And I would tell you all at the outset that obviously our time for to ask questions of you is limited, but there are many questions that we have of you, and many of those will be submitted to you in writing by the staffs, and hopefully you would respond to them in a timely fashion, because we're here, after all, to help you, so to speak, to do the job. Dr. Deaton, you mentioned a VA research study that might help with antiviral treatment for pandemic influenza. Will you tell us more about that without using, hopefully, all of my 5 minutes?
Yes, sir. I think you refer to our study of the combination of the drug oseltamivir with a drug called probenecid. Probenecid is an old drug that's been around a long time, sir, that is actually a generic drug that we've observed has a property that it slows down the excretion or metabolism of other drugs that that I might take. And so by giving that drug with the drug oseltamivir, we might effectively stretch the limited supply that we have of that drug. So VA has now initiated that study. It's been approved by the FDA. It's been approved by VA for funding. We expect to start in a few weeks, where we will study the combination of those two drugs to see the blood level of the drug oseltamivir, and hopefully the results will demonstrate if we can use that drug to effectively extend our nation's supply of oseltamivir, which is in a limited worldwide shortage.
Now tell me, I've always been curious about research and concerned about overlap, although I realize a lot of overlap just necessarily has to take place. Is your research coordinated, let's say, with CDC, with DOD, with HHS, et cetera?
The research study itself involves probably less than 100 patients. We can do it interior to the VA pretty quickly and pretty easily. We've got a pretty vigorous research program. Obviously, we've communicated with CDC, DOD, and other agencies that we're doing this research, and we've fortunately received lots of encouragement to move ahead rapidly. I get a call about every other week from staff at CDC and HHS and DOD about the status of that research project, because if the results are positive, it's going to help all of us.
So your CDC is sort of depending upon and looking to the VA to sort of continue on with this research, so that it can be helpful, well, not only just to the veterans or the VA, but to all Americans, is that right, or everybody in the world, actually. Is that correct, Doctor?
Yes, and I think that's the beauty of the collaboration.
Uh-huh.
We, the VA, we work very close when we're developing, like, recommendations, and then a lot of the research that is being done at the VA can help us then to review and revise some national policies. And I think the example with MRSA is a very nice example that we start the collaboration with a local VA. We saw a major improvement in the prevention of MRSA. Then it became, and now it's a CDC recommendation, and we're expanding our collaboration not just for more VA hospitals, but for the whole region in Pennsylvania. So I think that's the beauty of the collaboration. And we agree with your initial points, Mr. Chairman, that I think that's the way we're going to, that's the only way we'll be able to fight the pandemic, is really working together and learning from each other.
Well, is CDC basically, if anybody in effect is in charge, because you have DOD and you have HHS and then you have the VA, et cetera. So if anybody is in charge, so to determine this collaboration and coordination and whatnot, is it CDC?
HHS is responsible for the health piece of the plan. The president is responsible for the whole response. And there's several activities related to public health. They are related to CDC. Some of the research that are being done for pandemic involve not just CDC, but NIH and other groups. But there is a lot of, like it was said before, groups that are looking at that and working together. So not just CDC, but HHS, we are really looking at all the pieces
of
research.
Yeah, I just hope that they're working together as much as you say that they are. And that's why, you know, we've intended to have the other departments here, agencies and departments here. In terms of sufficient stockpiles, I mean, VA has their stockpiles, DOD have their stockpiles, et cetera. Who is responsible are they just responsible for their own stockpiles? Or is someone's got to be in charge to determine whether there are adequate stockpiles and where they're located and whatnot, so that one group can maybe use the other stockpiles if needed, et cetera?
Very good question, sir, particularly as we're planning for the possibility of a pandemic. There are limited supplies of the drug oseltamivir, which may be useful. There's very limited supplies of vaccine for a possible pandemic influenza. So the national plan is being developed specifically to articulate those kinds of issues. Each agency has different stockpiles. There is the strategic national stockpile, which CDC operates for the whole nation, mostly to distribute to states and federal health care systems. VA and DOD also have established some stockpile of the drug oseltamivir. And what the plan will be doing, and again, the national plan is due to be released January 1st, will be articulating how the coordination of whatever supply we have will be used when we need it. Dr. Cardo may have other points.
No, I agree 100% with what you said. Just one example of how we collaborate, at least CDC and the VA, during the shortage of influenza vaccine. The VA had its own vaccine and had enough for your population and donated vaccines to CDC so we could use for additional needs. So there is a lot of, because we are going to learn as soon as things happen, it's something that we need to learn, especially with the pandemic. You see that most of the things we say is things that we kind of predicted may happen, but they may be different. So I think the communication, not just in the national level, but also in the local levels, are being extremely important to facilitate the collaboration. But I think I just want to highlight again that the stockpiles for both antiviral drugs and vaccines are very small compared to the potential needs.
Yeah, thank you. I know my time is long over. Mr. Strickland.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I've been interested in your questions about collaboration and coordination because it seems to me with the government being as big as it is and these agencies being as complicated as they seem to be to me, that it's really important that there be some way to make sure that all agencies understand what's being done by various other parts of our government, and I would just hope that's happening. I have a couple of questions about this oseltamivir. How long does it take to get a larger supply of this? You say it's been around a while, and it's kind of a generic. Is that correct? And you're finding that it may have this beneficial effect?
Yes, sir. The drug oseltamivir is an antiviral drug that may be effective against this this avian flu, this pandemic flu that may be circulating. The drug that we are studying to give in combination with the oseltamivir is called probenecid, and that is the drug, sir, that is a generic drug and it's been around a long time.
Now, do you have an adequate supply of that drug?
Good question. First, we don't know if it's really going to be effective in doing what we hope it will. If it is effective, then I think certainly everybody will be interested in making sure we have an adequate supply to give in combination with the drug oseltamivir. It's a drug which is, I'm not a chemist, but I understand is relatively easy to make, and so I would expect particularly the manufacturer of the drug oseltamivir would be very interested in making sure that there was enough probenecid around. Certainly the Strategic National Stockpile, I'm sure, would be very invested in making sure that there was enough oseltamivir to give in combination to make maximal use for the public. So there's multiple, I'll bet you the Generic Manufacturers Association would be very interested in ramping up supply of that drug. And quite frankly, if there is inadequate supply, we, the various agencies of the federal government, would roll up our sleeves and make it ourselves, probably. We have that capability.
Now, when you talk about a stockpile, do these drugs degrade over time? When you place a drug in the stockpile, how long is it likely to be effective, or does it have to be continuously replaced?
We manage stockpiles very aggressively, in fact, to make sure that drugs that are in stockpile are actively and they haven't expired. So there's a routine of rotation and placement, replacement of drugs that might be coming close to their expiration date. And that's how we manage all stockpiles. And CDC manages the Strategic National Stockpile in exactly that fashion. And there are smart people who understand logistics that have tracked the expiration dates and make sure they're rotating older drugs out and replacing them with new drugs. Vicki, did you want to add?
But the Fortunately, the shelf life of oseltamivir is quite long. It's at least 5 years.
Great, great. Dr. Dayton, you had described using resources to make sure that staff was vaccinated and appropriate vaccinations took place of your patient population and so on. The hope being that you could prevent illness and perhaps save lives, but also save resources and save money. And I guess the question, you know, that I would have is, I mean, that just seems to make sense, common sense. But I'm wondering if you've collected any data to support the beneficial effects of what you've tried to do.
There's a considerable amount of literature and research studies and data that do demonstrate that the more people get influenza vaccination, the less illness there is, both from influenza, other respiratory infections, cardiac disease, and other diagnoses. So there's lots of literature on that. Some of it actually has been done by VA researchers. Dr. Kristen Nickel is a part of our system, and she's done a lot of the work here. CDC has sponsored really most of this research. There's very good evidence that is the direction to go, which is why we take so seriously the influenza vaccination, because in the VA system, obviously, we care for a group of veterans who, on average, are older and have other chronic medical conditions. So the more veterans who use our system that can be vaccinated, the better everybody is, certainly the individual veterans and their families, and as you say, sir, also the whole VA system. It's also why we're taking very seriously making sure our staff do a better job at getting vaccinated. We saw last year with the shortage, we saw staff that were actually sort of stepping back and saying, no, I'll hold off and not be vaccinated because let's save this vaccine for our veterans. Well, that's penny wise and pound foolish. And so we're working on making sure the penetration of vaccination among our staff gets better and better. So the kind of results like Dr. Muter told us about is very exciting, that we want to make sure and learn from that and replicate that across the system.
Mr. Chairman, I just have one more question for Dr. Muter. Dr. Muter, you take care of a lot of my constituents because I represent the Southern Ohio border, and a lot of my constituents come to your hospital, and I've been there to visit. I've always been incredibly impressed by the Pittsburgh VA facilities. But you describe for us what you're doing and its beneficial effects. But I'm wondering if the model that you're using is unique to your facility because of what exists in Pittsburgh. And, you know, you talked about collaboration with the university and so on. Can the model that you've described be easily implemented, in your judgment, across the VA system? Or is it something that's unique to your particular circumstances?
I think that much of what we do can actually be implemented throughout the VA. We are very fortunate. We are on the university campus. Our physicians are faculty members. We have lots of resources at our disposal in terms of expertise. But many of the things that we do, I think, are things that don't necessarily require that level of expertise. I think they require the determination of the people in the individual facilities to do it. One example would be our MRSA initiative. We've actually gotten a lot of inquiries from other VAs in our VISN who are seriously considered doing it, and they range in complexity from the Philadelphia VA, which is very similar to ours, to the Butler VA, which is essentially a rural long-term care facility. Things like immunizing people, doing surveillance for infectious diseases, providing isolation practices, really don't require a university faculty to do. I think there are things that perhaps we all should be doing, things that can be done in the community. And I think the thing what it takes is actually the knowledge and a little bit of resources, but I think the resources necessary are not overwhelming and are well within the capability of most medical centers And in fact, again, I'm speaking for myself and not for the VA as an institution, but I think there is ample evidence that comes both from the CDC, from the VA and the private sector, that efforts to decrease infection through immunization or through appropriate infection control really are very, very cost effective, and they're highly effective at preventing illness and death. So, for example, some estimates of MRSA infection, depending on whether it's a soft tissue infection or a bacteremia, range from $10,000 to $30,000 per episode, so that you don't have to prevent a lot of illness to really recoup your investment in terms of personnel or laboratory supplies or immunization supplies. And I think we've been very fortunate, and our administration understands this, and I think that they have they understand that this is an appropriate thing to do from an appropriateness of medical care and also from a cost-effectiveness standpoint.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, sir. Mr. Bozeman to inquire.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I want to compliment you all. It sounds like you have a great story to tell and are well on the way to being very, very prepared, and certainly, you know, we'll support you any way we can in helping you to get further prepared. I just have a couple kind of curious questions. Your role is such that in the VA, you know, you certainly, you know, we have the function of providing for the VA family. And then also in the role of a disaster, you know, you kind of kick into another gear. If we had a full-blown 1918 type situation, how do you prioritize? Do the VA, do they get first priority, or at that point is it, do you declare something else, and is it just kind of first come, first serve? Or?
It really depends upon the what's going on and what the president has said and what the governor has said. So certainly VA priority always is to deliver high-quality health care to our veterans. Our second priority, congressionally mandated priority, is also to back up the Department of Defense health care system. So that is our second priority. Our third priority is obviously to be there for the nation in any disaster hits. So if the president invokes the Stafford Act and there is a presidentially declared emergency, each VA actually is delegated authority to do what they think is the best thing to do for both the veterans, if there's DOD health care, as well as the communities in which they reside. And so since you can't say that what's going to work in the Pittsburgh area is going to be exactly what's going to work in, say, Southern California, you do want each individual VA facility to have the authority to respond in whatever way is necessary for what's going on there.
And then I guess hopefully, you know, in our modeling exercises, that is part of what goes on. How about the other things? I know, you know, we talk about Tamiflu and this, you know, this is a respiratory disease. Are we adequately stocked with the other things that you need to fight this kind of situation? You know, if you had a 1918, or if we had a, I guess the important thing with this is that, you know, this is also a great exercise in getting ready for this. We're also getting ready for a biological attack or a nuclear attack or whatever to some extent. So again, are we looking at, I hope in our modeling, are we looking at being able to have adequate supplies of the other?
Yes, sir. That certainly is a factor that is being built into the tabletop exercises and the modelings. It's hard to know exactly what to respond to until it starts to happen and what you're really going to need. But we already have learned from the activities we've done. For example, the plan that we're putting in place in the VA system that we're building, again, flowing from the national strategy and the national plan for pandemic influenza, we're actually modeling after what we did for smallpox. It's not that different. And so we've all developed a lot of expertise in the kind of system-wide responses that have to be put in place, all the resources that have to be brought to bear. How do you ensure staff are adequate and are protected to come in and do their job, the facilities stay open, the house cleaning continues on. The cafeteria workers continue, etc. They're all serious and very important aspects of preparation. The stockpile issue is one of many. Do we have enough antibiotics, enough IV fluids, and things like that?
Very good. Thank you.
I think the chair thanks the gentleman. Dr. Deaton, let me ask you very quickly. All veterans are eligible for the flu shot?
Veterans who are eligible and enrolled for VA care can come to any VA facility.
But only those veterans, not veterans. I don't have a purple card, for instance. I forget about being a member of Congress. Am I eligible for it?
If you have not enrolled for VA health care, VA can't take care of you until you do. But veterans who have not yet enrolled for eligibility, I would encourage.
Well, but if a veteran doesn't qualify under our criteria, they have not enrolled for VA health care. But one of the priorities, therefore, that veteran is not going to be eligible to walk into the VA. In other words, these posters, which are great posters, are used where? In the VA facility?
Yes, sir.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
They've been I'm proud to say, sir, that they've been adopted by many other private health care providers, DOD, Australia, Wales, et cetera. But these, what you see here, are taken from VA facilities.
So the VA, the veterans posts, the VFW, the American Legion, et cetera, something like this would not be posted in their facility because many of those people do not have the purple card and consequently would not be able to get the flu shot.
Well, two responses, sir. VA has legal authority to deliver care to eligible veterans. I can't give health care to veterans who aren't eligible and enrolled for VA health care. However, you've raised another point. I should probably, as soon as I get back to the office, call the VFW and the American Legion and start distributing these posters to them because, in fact, I don't care how veterans get the message as long as they get the message. All veterans should be seeking a flu shot, be it from the VA if they're eligible and enrolled, from their private provider, from their public health clinic, from their state health department, mm-hmm. wherever they can get the flu shot, because we think it's going to be good for all of them.
Good. Yeah, good. All right. And I would suggest that you do that because that's all part of the game here. And they could be just as susceptible to the serious illness as anyone else as a result of some
absolutely.
Sort of
for example, we know data. I mean, we study this intensively because we're so concerned about it. We know that last year and the year before, 45% of veterans who did get a flu shot got their flu shot outside of the VA. Mm-hmm. So of those veterans who could come to the VA, 45% of them got their shots.
Well, they're not expensive. I know my son is an internist, and they're far from expensive. In fact, a heck of a lot more, but more expense than the reimbursement would be for giving them. Well, I don't know. It would be less than $15, I think. Is it something like that?
What's the question?
Do you know... Dr. Cardo, the reimbursement to a physician who gives a flu shot, you know, Medicare reimbursement, for instance?
No, I don't have that information.
It's such a ridiculous. Anybody in the audience know? It's such a ridiculously low figure.
Seems it is about 18.
18. All right. See.
But Mr. Chairman, you've raised a very, very, I think, important and interesting point. And that has to do with the demand for influenza vaccination, which has been, quite frankly, from an infectious disease point of view, from a public health point of view, the demand has not been anywhere close to what it should be. All of us at this table, I hope all of you up there also, will really work hard to promote the importance of influenza vaccination for the public.
Yeah.
It is I forgot who asked the question, but it is a good preventive tool. It works at what it's supposed to do. It decreases respiratory infections. It decreases hospitalizations. And we all need to get behind it and let the public know that this is good preventive practice. It's not as valued as it should be. And I think all of us would want to work out ways for VA, for CDC, for Congress, for the President, all to get behind a major national campaign of influenza vaccination.
Dr. Cardo wants to.
Thank you. I just want to take this opportunity to highlight the importance of vaccination, flu vaccination, and also some of the strategies that they're doing at the VA to promote like hand hygiene and respiratory hygiene. While we know that the stockpiles may not contain enough antiviral medications and we don't have a vaccine for potential pandemic virus, we know that there's several strategies that we can take right now that can help us, not just with the flu season, but also in preparing for a possible pandemic. And I think those strategies that we see that the VA is doing is the strategies that we really encourage all healthcare facilities to do. And I think the communication piece that the VA has is something that we are using at CDC also to help other facilities to promote those strategies.
You know, we have newsletters. Of course, we've curtailed those greatly as a result of people saying we're using taxpayers' dollars to promote ourselves or whatever. But our newsletters theoretically goes into every household in our congressional districts. Be a great way to do it.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I became a believer last year because of the shortage. I was over at the physician's office, and they offered me a shot, and I said, you know, there's a shortage, and so I chose not to take it. And I was sicker last year than I've been in maybe the last 20 years. It was an incredible experience. So no one had to convince me this year that this was an appropriate thing to do.
Yeah. I'm allergic to eggs, and so I haven't been taking it. I remember I took one many, many years ago, and I got sick. I got flu. So I commended the VA because staff, reading through materials and their research and whatnot, assured me that the VA was doing a real good job at this. And I meant that. There are gaps. And I know, you know, the big problem that I've found, 24 years, next year will be my 24th and last year here, is turf. In fact, that's part of the problem of not being able to get some of these people here and whatnot. It's turf fights and things of that nature. So I know then you have the bureaucracy and you have the organizational charts and things of that nature. But if there are ways that you think that the Congress can be helpful to help fill in some of those gaps, and to take care of some of these problems that, you know, as a result of turfs and jurisdictional fights and things of that nature don't take place, so please don't hesitate to let us know. In the meantime, we thank you so very much, and I know we've learned a lot. There aren't many of us here, but this is a small subcommittee, so I think there are only a couple people missing, as a matter of fact. Thanks. Thanks so much. And again, we will be submitting a number of questions to you. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Hearing is adjourned.